tonight on Arena. Nomadland, Wild Mountain Time, and Here Are the Young Men are the movies up for review. And we speak to Olivia Lang about her new book, Everybody. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And as is usually our usual custom, we'll be starting with film reviews on this Thursday evening. But before we get into the reviews themselves, news that from May the 10th, that's Monday week, galleries, museums, libraries and other cultural attractions can reopen. Now, we had been hearing that cinemas would be reopening from June the 7th, but that seems now not to be the case. No concrete news so on when cinemas and theatres will be reopening. But if there's any clarification on any of that while we're on air, we'll keep you up to date. So let's go then to this weekend's releases. Listeners, this week's selection of films is a real spoil for you, I think. First up, the film of 2021 so far, Nomadland, which took the big gongs at the Oscar last weekend. Also, Wild Mountain Time, a charming tale of love in rural Ireland. Or the latest in the litany of crimes against the beautiful and difficult to reproduce Irish accent. And we'll review Here Are the Young Men, Owen McMacken's film adaptation of Rob Doyle's novel, starring, among others, Anya Taylor-Joy, she of Queen's Gambit fame. Angela Flannery, John Maguire have been to the virtual cinema for us, and they join me virtually this evening as well. We'll start with Nomadland. Director Chloe Zhao's heartfelt road movie tells the story of a woman called Fern, Oscar-winning turn from Frances McDormand, and Fern adopts the life of van-dwelling nomad after the death of her husband, the loss of her job and the disappearance of her own town. Angela, it really is an overtly political film, there's no doubt about that, but maybe just give us a sense of exactly who these people were who emerged after the crash of 2008 and the kind of lifestyle that they found themselves either by choice or by necessity living.
Yes, Sean. After the crash of 2007, 2000 to 2009, older people in general in America, I think, of a certain class found themselves displaced. And there was a book written about this called Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century by a writer called Jessica Bruder. Now, Frances McDormand bought the rights to that book, and that's what Chloe Zhao has based this film on. So these people, you know, it was a group of older Americans who after the crash ended up adopting transient lifestyles and migrating from state to state in their twilight years in their RVs and camper vans looking for seasonal work. And so what Zhao has done here is she's taken the real life accounts of some of the people from Bruder's book, Linda May, a character called Swanky, well, a woman called Swanky, and Bob Wells. And she's interwoven their stories with the story of this fictional woman called Fern, who's played by Frances McDormand herself. And Fern, they've created a fictional narrative around that, you know, is this woman who came from this town in Nevada called Empire, which is a real town, which fascinatingly, at the beginning of the film, we're told that the American Gypsum Company was based there. Thousands of people lived there. But when the mine closed after the crash, that the town was abandoned, almost like what we would think of as famine villages or abandoned islands. And all of the people were just told to get out of it. People who had children in school were given 6 months to get out of it. And the town effectively shut down. So they created this fictional character of Fern, who's a woman who lived in that town. And when the town shut down, she basically, her husband had died in the meantime, no children. She hit the road and suddenly she becomes one of these nomads. So you have this really interesting kind of interwoven docudrama, dramatization type of film where Frances McDormand plays this character who interacts with real life nomads and they travel around together in, you know, through America.
Well, let's listen to one of those interactions, as you say, Frances McDormand acting here a role, the role of Fern, and she's showing Linda May, a real person, and she's showing Linda May around her van.
So the guy that had the van before, he just had a mattress in the back, but I didn't want to keep it that way. I wanted to build the bed up so I could have storage underneath. I got these storage drawers, one set in the front so I could get in them from the inside, and then another on the outside.
Very smart.
I thought so. You see that? This is my husband's old fishing box. I put this little latch on it, and then when I open it, the stopper holds it and creates more counter space. And then I keep my really nice stuff inside. My dishes that my dad gave me, he collected these, Linda May, from yard sales. And when I graduated from high school, he gave me the whole set.
Oh,
isn't that
beautiful.
Great? Yeah, it's called Autumn Leaf. I don't have that many pieces with me, but you know.
What did you name your van?
Vanguard.
Oh, that is very strong.
She is.
Frances McDormand as Fearn there, and Linda May being Linda May in that scene from Nomadland. And John McGuire, that scene for me perfectly captures this. You know, listen to that and tell me who the actor is and tell me who the non-actor is. Now, I sometimes go out in a bit of a rash when I hear non-actors because I think, you know, good actors shouldn't look as if they're acting well. But that scene really shows you how well the two things work together.
It does. And Zhao is, that's her, that's the way she's worked so far in her two previous film songs, My Brother Taught Me and The Rider. She takes real situations and structures a film around that. It's not quite documentary. It's not quite drama. It's somewhere in a liminal space between them that's actually engrossing and fascinating to watch. And what she's trying to capture here is living simply and simply living. And she, the grander scheme of the film is about entire lives sacrificed at the altar of economic recessions and depressions and the real poverty in heartland America. But it's also about the landscape and the people she meets. And mostly it's about Frances McDormand's magnetic presence, her face, her demeanor, her uncanny ability to communicate complex and authentic emotional states. And it's really a masterful work from a really talented filmmaker and the best actress of her generation.
I'll come to mind. I'll come back to you, John, for sure. But Angela, I mean, we heard it there in that clip. What really amazes me is that Frances McDormand, it's not that she lessens the quality of her performance to match those of the non-actors, but the non-actors themselves are not over-directed. They're not trying to act. It's the best thing they could do. They're just telling their own story. But it's not only about acting and non-acting here. The look of this film is quite astonishing as well.
Yeah, it's an incredibly beautiful film. The cinematography is just stunning. The British cinematographer, Joshua James Richards, was the person who worked on this. Now, he is Chloe Zhao's partner, and he also shot her films that John's just mentioned, their songs, My Brother Taught Me and The Rider. So they obviously work together very closely, know each other very well. My God, can you tell? I mean, it is just so beautiful. The landscape that you are, different landscapes that you are brought into. We have a tendency, I think, to think of America as being about the big cities, the coasts, Florida, Vegas, you know, all of this. And we miss out on all of these incredible landscapes in the Dakotas and Nevada, Arizona, the desert, the Pacific Northeast. All of that is in this and it is jaw-dropping. It's so, so beautiful. Like it's almost just, it's spiritual to watch. And I'm not that type of person, if you know what I mean. But I found it so moving and so hopeful and just extraordinary. Just, and it's such a disaster that we're not going to get to see it in a cinema. That's, well, the tragedy of this.
Yeah, I would sincerely hope. Now, I know there's kind of confusion tonight as to when cinemas might actually be opening back up again. But surely this will deserve an outing in the cinema, because it's going to be available, isn't it, at the weekend on Disney Plus. Not everybody has a Disney Plus. They mightn't want to get a subscription to Disney Plus just to see this one film. The cinema will be the place to see it, John.
Oh, I think so, absolutely. And Joshua James Richards' work is exceptional, but has been in all the three films. He was nominated for an Oscar as well. He didn't get it, but to me, the two of them work so well together. What they're trying to do is less about create a series of narrative incidents and hang a plot on an idea or a concept. They're trying to capture a state of being, which is, it's like what John Ford tried to do when he, and Chloe Zhao here has a specific reference to The Searchers towards the end of Nomadland. And it's astonishing to me that you have this Chinese-born young woman who comes over to the States, gets into the Midwest and is making neo-Westerns. She's making these Western films that have as much heart and as much emotion as what John Ford was doing 70 years ago. That to me is really exciting. And it's that exceptional technique that she has that blurs the line between reality and fiction. It's almost hyper-real as a viewing experience, where the characters are all informed by real lived experiences, and you can feel that when you're watching it. It's exceptional work, it really is.
Let's listen to one scene just before we wrap up and get your stars, where it's all actors that are involved in this. Ferd at one point goes to visit her sister, and there's a conversation that takes place around the whole idea of real estate and what it has come to mean in the 21st century.
Things are looking good right now. The prices are going up. You know, 2012, it's a winner.
Yeah.
I mean, I wish I would have the money in 2008 to buy everything so I could sell it now. I mean, it seems like real estate always ends up on the upside.
I don't want to disagree with you, but I have to say I do. It's strange that you encourage people to invest their whole life savings, go into debt, just to buy a house they can't afford.
Fern, that's a rather limited look at what we do.
Is it limited, George?
I mean, we're not all in a position to just chuck everything and hit the road.
Oh, you think that's what I've done, George? I chucked everything, George, to hit the road? Is that what I did?
All right, I'm sorry.
You know, I think that what the nomads are doing is not that different than what the pioneers did. I think Fern's part of an American tradition. I think it's great.
Scene there from Nomadland, where Fern, played by Frances McDormand, visits her sister and brother-in-law. Is the politics of this a little bit on the nose at times, Angela? And did you have any qualms about any aspects of the film?
No, I didn't find it political at all. In fact, I found it a blessed relief from not having to, you know, it's pre-Trump, and it seems like an America that's much less divisive and that's much less violent and there's much less hatred in it. So I was quite relieved by that. But I mean, of course, they're talking about Lehman Brothers. They're talking about, you know, homes being repossessed. So that actually makes the film sound more political, that clip that you played there. But I liked that because there you saw Frances McDormand really acting. And that was my one reservation about this. And I've grappled with this. I think Frances McDormand is amazing. I love her, but I'm finding it increasingly difficult to distinguish between where Frances McDormand ends and where the characters begin. And it's a similar problem. John's going to disagree with me because I'm going to mention Bill Murray. I have the problem with him as well. And yet my favourite film, Olive Kitteridge, has both of them playing opposite each other. But I really just, you know, they just sort of become each other. And I really didn't feel like she deserved the Oscar. I thought Andra Day did. That's my reservation about it. She's amazing in it. But she is Frances McDormand. I never got it out of my head that she was Fern. She never felt like Fern to me.
And what are you saying? Stars. Give me stars, Angela, just before we finish.
Four.
Four from you. And John, do you want to retort on the Bill Murray aspect? Well, always been Bill Murray.
I would say it's digging around in the research for the film. Frances McDormand apparently told her husband, Joel Cohen, that when she was 65, she was going to quit acting, change her name to Fern, and travel the Midwest in an RV van. This was years before Nomadland was even a concept. So this is something that she's had in her for years and years. And I think that's I think that's what Angela is picking up on, is that she's Fern and she's Frances McDormand. I think that's what. But for me, this is a 5-star film. I absolutely adored it. Absolutely adored it.
5 stars from you, John, and 4 from Angela for Nomadland. On the subject of films, by the way, we've just got a slight update. Culture Minister Catherine Martin has confirmed that the government is, quote, looking at the safe reopening of cinemas and theatres in June. She said that Cabinet today also agreed that her department, along with the Department of Health and Department of the Taoiseach, will, again, this is a quote, will prepare proposals on the holding of a limited number of pilot large events for sport and music, including both indoor and outdoor. And she added, details will be firmed up in the weeks ahead. So we'll be delighted to hear the detail on when we might get into a cinema or into a theatre again, and indeed those big indoor and outdoor events as well. Let us move on to film number 2, Irish-American dramatist John Patrick Shanley, the man who scripted Moonstruck and indeed wrote the phenomenally successful play Doubt, which was subsequently made into a film. He gives us Wild Mountain Time, adapted from his Broadway play Outside Mullingar, starring the beautiful pairing of Emily Blunt and Jamie Dornan. This is a love story set in the wilds of the Irish countryside. I feel I should put on a soft Irish voice, and it all sounds innocuous enough. But dear listeners, this is one of the most controversial film releases of this year. Angela, we will get to the accents in due course, but just so that those who haven't seen it can follow what we're talking about, give us the basic setup here.
It's that old chestnut about who's going to get the family farm. And so we have Tony Riley, who is played bizarrely by Christopher Walken. I'm sure we're going to come to that. He plans to sell the family farm before he dies to his American nephew, who is played by John Hamm, instead of leaving it to his own son, Anthony Jamie Dornan, because Anthony's a bit of an oddball. Like, he really is kind of touched in a way with the fairies, and he's in danger of becoming a 40-year-old virgin and never getting a wife and never looking after the farm. So, the father thinks this is a better idea. He's also secretly in love with his beautiful neighbour, Rosemary Muldoon, who's played by Emily Blunt. And Rosemary doesn't know that Anthony's in love with her because he can't express himself, and she's also in love with him. And the twist, Rosemary owns the road frontage, the access to the farm. So John Hamm is going to have to negotiate with her if he wants the farm. And that's basically it.
All right. Well, let's get a sense of how they manage with each other. Anthony and Rosemary flirting, kind of. Jamie Dornan and Emily Blunt in action in this.
Anthony! Are you all right?
I'm fine.
What are you doing out there?
Fishing.
That was fishing?
Yeah.
Without a rod? Who were you talking to?
I wasn't talking.
You looked to be talking, then swatting, then you jumped in.
I did not. It's a Kelly's to jump in. I'm a Riley.
You're a Riley.
What are you doing down by the river?
What I've been doing after this one.
Oh, you're not still from the night before.
I am.
Well, God in heaven, you look the worst for it.
Well, thanks much. You don't look perfect yourself.
There you go. And inevitably, at the top of that clip, he was standing in a little, what do you call the little round boats that he's in? What's the name of those? I think you had it written in.
Coracle, Sean.
Thank you very much, John. Coracle. And
Age coracle.
Yeah. And he falls out into the water. Surprise, surprise. One of several pratfalls that he does. But there you have it, John. I mean, how bad are those, or how good are those, or how kind of almost acceptable are those accents in that scene?
I think we have to get over that as a nation. We have to get over the fact that actors who are not Irish, even though Jamie Dornan is Irish, God love him, they will come here and they will have a go, and we have to get over that. This film is not made necessarily for Ireland alone. It's a film made for anybody who wants to watch a romantic comedy. And representations of Ireland and Irishness are sensitive subjects, obviously, but we have to kind of step back a little bit from it. What I was rubbing my ears over was the kind of parade of cliches, because it's like Darby O'Gill, really, some of it. Like Angela said, there's a fight over land and frontage. We have these emotionally stunted gombeens pratfalling in the rain. There's the coracle we just mentioned. They're singing songs in the pub. There's flat caps, horses. The landscape is this crayon green, lurid crayon green. There's a donkey. There's long conversations about the qualities of bottled Guinness. The cliches are inexhaustible. Yeah. Yeah, well, and now, it wouldn't matter a damn to me, Sean, if the film was set in Outer Mongolia and not in Mayo, and if it was bottled yak's milk they were talking about and not Guinness. The horrors that John Patrick Shanley is inflicting on cinema is the problem. It's not Ireland. Yeah. It's cinema that's the victim here.
Okay, well, hold on a little minute now, Angela. You might come back on this. This is the man who gave us Moonstruck. Now, I'm not Italian, but I would hazard a guess that the Italians wouldn't think that the kind of Italian that you see in Moonstruck is gritty realism either.
No, they wouldn't. But what you have to remember is those are American Italians, and it's set in Brooklyn. It's not set in Naples, you know. And I do wonder what Italians thought when they saw that film. You know, I'm sure they thought, who are these people? It's the way, you know, we would look at Irish Americans are hyper Irish, you know, and
this really is for them. And it's for not just them, it's for everybody else apart from us. You know, it is, as John says. I mean, we look at this and it's like your eyes are bleeding watching it. You know, your ears are bleeding. The whole thing is, what is this?
Yeah.
But I really feel that this is going to be seen as charming escapism outside of Ireland, which people are going to have a big appetite for right now, and that people will enjoy it. We won't enjoy it. I mean, I even question the sense in releasing it in Ireland, because we hate stereotypes, yeah, no matter how well-intentioned they are. And there is no way that, you know, John Patrick Shanley intended this as some sort of insult, yeah, or cliche to Irish people. He absolutely adores Ireland. That's clear in this. But you know what? When this came out as a play on Broadway and it was released, I remember reading Fintan O'Toole's review of it, and it was so scathing, unbelievably scathing. It was funny to read, to be honest with you. But you know, that play was nominated for a Tony Award that year.
Yeah, well, I suppose, you know? How do you get you nominated for a Tony Award is a whole other set of arguments. But let's have a listen to Christopher Walken in action. I actually found this, I laughed a couple of times, I have to admit that, not only at various cliches, but some of the lines were, gave you a little bit of a titter. This is Christopher Walken speaking to Emily Blunt's character. I'm sure, what else would they be talking about other than land, although there's something else at play here as well.
Are you in love with Anthony?
It's more than love.
Don't be. Now go while your damn gates are open.
No, I'm not done with you.
He's not normal.
I don't care.
He'll never marry.
Well, then neither will I, and he will be in his house and I'll be in mine.
Rosemary!
Be quick, I need to pee. And you'd sell to a Yank, would you?
He's a Riley.
He's a Yank.
You're trespassing now.
Drop this plot or I'll kill you.
Would you have the place go on auction? Anthony will never marry.
Oh, he will.
Wake up! Look to yourself.
No, and if it comes to that, I'll freeze my eggs.
You'll what?
I'll freeze my eggs. If he's slow, I'll wait.
You should freeze your whole body if you're waiting for that one.
I believe he will come to me.
I need this settled.
Did you like that joke about freezing your whole body, Angela?
Yeah, there were a couple of times I did laugh, actually, I have to say. The actions are so bizarre, but I mean, you know, this idea of freezing your eggs. This film looks like an Amdram production from the 1950s. The costumes, everything in it. There's young people in it who say things like bad cess. I found myself looking that up going, like, I don't even have elderly relatives from my childhood who ever used that expression. Going, am I missing out on something? I'm going to start using it again. Yeah. But they wear flat caps and tweed. They don't have mobile phones. And there she is talking about getting her eggs frozen. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of funny.
Yeah, but you did, there was a little shout across the field there from Rosemary's mother, played by Dervla Molloy. I think you kind of thought she was the one who managed to hit the kind of good-humoured quality of what was looked for here.
Yeah, she did. There's a scene where she's talking about a bit of ham that was quite funny. But she also played Maeve Muldoon in the Broadway production, so she knows this inside out. You know, she's got form when it comes to this.
John, you're just totally and absolutely scathing on this one until it gets to the last
little bit. But that's it. This film, and we're not giving anything away here.
Yeah.
This film has the greatest surprise ending I've seen in years. It took me absolutely by... It floored me. I had no idea what I was watching. I had to rewind it and watch it again, just in case I had dreamt it. And what we thought we were watching becomes something else absolutely entirely. It becomes a kind of a fantasy. And it totally surprised me. And I would almost recommend that people watch the film just for that last 20 minutes or so.
Right, so you have to watch
an
hour.
The rug is completely pulled out from underneath you. You have to go through, you have to endure a lot to get to that point. But I think it's worth it. I think it's worth it just for, because you'll never see anything like it again.
All right, that sounds as if you're both kind of recommending it for different reasons. Stars from you, John.
It's a one-star film, but it has a five-star ending. So let's say one star, Sean.
But wait for the ending and you'll get five stars. Angela?
Do you know, I actually see the merit of a film like this. I think we need it. The Irish film industry needs it, and I think people will come to Ireland. Cross Malina and Ballina look amazing. I thought, geez, I'm moving to Mayo. It's gorgeous. I'm going to put on the green jersey here and give it two stars.
Two stars. 2 stars. I'm glad you put the jersey on. If you didn't have it on, I'd be worried what you'd be giving it. All right, 2 stars and 1 star, respectively, with the 5 star ending for Wild Mountain Time. And finally, then, let's go to Owen Macken's debut, directorial debut. Here Are the Young Men. Feature adaptation of Rob Doyle's 2014 novel of the same name tells the story of hedonism, violence, and growing up among a group of young Dublin friends. Talented young cast here, mega watch star Anya Taylor-Joy. From the chess TV programme, and Finn Cole of Peaky Blinders, Ferdia Walsh, Pilo, who we saw in Sing Street recently. I suppose that just give us a sense of where we are. We're in 2003, which is vitally important and maybe not that clear in the film where exactly we are in time, Angela.
It just tell us at the very beginning, but then you could kind of be anywhere between the 90s and now. That's another thing that we can come to. But yeah, so it's set at the peak of the Celtic Tiger in Dublin in 2003. And we meet three school friends, Matthew, Carney and Rez, who've just finished their Leaving Cert. And they're planning a summer of debauchery, partying, taking drugs. And they kick it off by vandalising their school. And then they go on this complete bender. And it's all great crack until out on one of their binges, they witness this horrible accident. And each of them is affected in a different way. The point of view character, and it's all seen through Matthew's perspective. He's going out with Jen, who is played by Anya Taylor-Joy. And so he kind of falls apart a little bit. You know, he's really struggling to cope with this. The Rez character, who's this sort of Nick Cave lookalike, who is Ferdia Walsh-Pilo, the only Irish actor in the main cast, actually, he completely falls apart and has a suicide attempt. And then the actor from Peaky Blinders, Finn Cole, turns out to have quite enjoyed what he saw, this violence. And that's really what's at the centre of this, is that Matthew realises that his friend Carney, played by Cole, is a psychopath. And what's he going to do now? How is he going to distance himself from, or is he going to get pulled in through their partying and their drugs and their obsession with all of this his world?
Yeah, let's listen to a clip from quite early on. Finn Cole as Carney describing his dream video game to Ferdia Walsh-Pilo as Rez, Dean Charles Chapman as Matthew, and they're all distracted by the arrival of Anya Taylor-Joy. The Queen's Gambit was the chess programme I was trying to think about, playing the beautiful Jen, and here is a clip from that.
So then you end up in England, and you have to take the war to the Brits, fucking bombing trains and shit and shooting everybody. And then at the end, you have to assassinate the Queen.
Hey, so they made a game about the RA where you have to plant bombs and kill the fucking Queen.
No, it's a game I invented. Call of the Provos, that's what I'm naming it.
This sounds great.
Okay, exactly. Tell me you wouldn't play that fucking game.
Probably wouldn't, man.
Boys, we're free. Here we are on the other side. Over. We made it. So, how'd it go? Really? Have you figured out what you're all gonna do now?
Yeah. I worked out my life spreadsheet last night.
Get high.
Make video games.
Good. I'm gonna be the next female president of the UN.
Seems like a lot of work.
Ugh, you're right. Fucks. Aw, all of the happy families.
You poor bastards. Once you have kids, that's everything fucked. May as well give up at that point.
Jesus, that's dark.
Actually, Jen, I think you look great pregnant.
Has anyone ever told you have an extremely punchable face, Carney?
I'm going for a walk.
I was just trying to be nice.
Sure.
There you go. Dean Charles Chapman, Anya Taylor-Joy, Ferdia Walsh-Pilo and Finn Cole all in the scene there from Here Are the Young Men. This in some ways is gritty realism with this edge of kind of the fantasy video game going on in the side as well, John.
Yeah, but narratively there's nothing here that we haven't seen 1,000 times before, Sean, but visually what Owen Macken is trying to do here, this scattershot use of different image formats, there's film, there's video, there's TV, it's chopped up editing. It makes an already obnoxious film feel like a very clumsy endurance test. His favourite recurring image for this examination of the Irish teen male psyche is a clenched fist. We see it over and over again, and I felt that I needed a lot more than that to follow these characters. It's kind of bombastic, and none of them really have any kind of internal life whatsoever. They're just going through the motions. And I felt particularly sorry for Anya Taylor-Joy, who's gone on to become a star since this film was shot in 2018, as Jen, this shared object of lust and the occasional voice of reason. Her part is very poorly underwritten, and there really isn't enough for her to do.
Angela,
All that flashy stuff. Sorry, Sean.
I think, Angela, certainly all of the performances here are up to scratch. And this novel was really good, and it did really well at the time, and kind of brought us into the minds of these young men. Somehow in the transfer to the screen, has that got lost?
Yeah, I agree with John completely that it has gotten lost. I mean, We Are the Young Men was one of a number of books by a new wave of Irish writers that came out on the tail of the Celtic Tiger. I mean, people like Colin Barrett, whose short story Calm with Horses, or a story from his collection Young Skins, would have become Calm with Horses. What Richard did was adapted from Kevin Power, who everyone's talking about now because of his new novel White City. But his last novel, Bad Day in Black Rock, became what Richard did, the Lenny Abramson film. And both of those deal with this idea of toxic masculinity to a certain extent, and of young men not knowing how to grow up and take responsibility. And that's also what Rob Doyle's novel, We Are the Young Men, is about. And it's an excellent novel. Like, the characterization in it is really nuanced. There's actually more characters in it. And he co-wrote the screenplay for this. And I kind of I just wish he'd stuck closer to the novel. Yeah. I don't know, who was the main writer on it, him or Macken, but it's an excellent novel. And this is a poor film. I mean, I just didn't engage with it.
So what does that mean in stars terms from you, Angela?
Oh, I'm afraid 2.5.
2.5 from you. And what are you saying, John?
I think Angela's been very generous. I think that despite all the flashy stylistic stuff that Macken is doing, what ultimately emerges in the film is this ill-considered, out-of-date morality tale in which these empty characters are awkwardly being herded into situations that determine right and wrong. It feels like cattle being pushed through a mart. And
stars.
It's a one-star film for me. I really didn't like it. One star.
Did not enjoy. One star from John, two from Andrew for Here Are the Young Men. Wild Mountain Time and Nomadland, the other two that we were talking about. Nomadland on Disney Plus on Friday, the other two on Video On Demand. Olivia Lang is the author of hybrid works of criticism, biography and memoir, including the best-selling non-fiction work Lonely City. Her first novel, Crudo, won the 2019 James Tate Memorial Prize, and she's a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature. Her collected writing on art, Funny Weather, Art at an Emergency, was published in 2020. Her latest book, Everybody, a book about freedom, charts a course through the long struggle for bodily freedom using the life of psychoanalyst Wilhelm Reich to explore gay rights and sexual liberation, feminism and the civil rights movement. It also touches on the lives of icons including Nina Simone, Malcolm X and Susan Sontag along the way. And I'm delighted to have Olivia Lang join me this evening. Every time I look at the book cover, Olivia, I can't decide whether I should say everybody or everybody, because bodies are hugely important here.
That is exactly what I wanted to do with that title, which I thought of when I was walking across the park one day, and I really liked it because it caught at both aspects of bodyment and then everyone, all of us.
Yeah, and in fact, today is the actual publication day. You can't have a launch party, obviously, because of everything that's happening at the moment. But I suppose the book is you've said this yourself, I think, is a kind of a party in its own right because it's full of bodies.
It's full of riotous bodies. It's full of sexual bodies. It's full of resistant bodies. It's full of tragic bodies. And, all my books are populated, but this one feels very intensely populated. So at least we get to hang out with some company.
And what was it that went you to, obviously you're looking at the human condition in many ways here, but you're looking at it through the prism of the body, the physical aspect of everything that happens to us. Was there something specific that sent you in that direction, Olivia?
I think I started the idea really in 2015, and it was the refugee crisis, and Britain was having the Brexit vote, Trump was coming to power, and there was this sense that bodies were imperiled once again, that people were in danger because of the kind of bodies they inhabited. And I wanted to just look back at the 20th century and try and understand why certain kinds of bodies are so threatening, why people tend to oppress and treat with violence certain kinds of bodies, and also how bodies through history have been a force for freedom, how people have gathered on the streets and changed the world that they live in.
And you do so very much through the prism of this psychoanalyst, Wilhelm Reich. Now, he's kind of a game of two halves, is Wilhelm Reich, isn't he, in terms of how he behaved himself?
I mean, he is a very difficult character, which is kind of what fascinated me about him. On the one hand, he's Freud's most brilliant protege. He's an incredibly exciting figure in Vienna and Berlin before the war. He tries to marry the ideas of Freud and Marx. He's a sexual liberationist. He's an anti-fascist. He's this thrilling person. And then I think over the course of the Second World War, what happens in Nazi Germany and his rejection by Freud, he ends up having a kind of breakdown. He moves to America and he starts coming up with these very pseudoscientific ideas about how the body can be healed. And he ends up persecuted by the Food and Drug Administration and he dies in a prison cell. So it's this really at once exhilarating and tragic story. And he's certainly not always likable, but I had this strong sense that some of his ideas were vital to our own times.
Yeah, and this is something interesting, and you bring this up at different points along the way. You know, the society that we live in today, you're either squeaky clean, absolutely perfect, you've never done anything wrong in your life, or that's it, you're gone, you're cancelled, you're out. So you go back to Wilhelm Reich. It's not that you're trying to rehabilitate him, but you're saying, okay, I'm not pretending that he was perfect, but let's look at things in the round. Let's look at the whole body, if you like, rather than just one part of it.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think every character in that book would have been cancelled, really, if you took some of the things they said or things they did out of context on Twitter. They would have been very unpopular. Andrea Dworkin is a very complicated figure. Nina Simone is a complicated figure. Sontag is a complicated figure. So what I wanted to do was really delve into people with difficult lives and difficult ideas and say, what's useful to us rather than what's palatable to us? It seems a much more fertile question to me.
But I do have to get you to talk about something that I don't know if it is useful to us or not. Reich's Orgone Accuser. Am I saying that right, by the way?
Are we going to do it? We're going to go there.
Oh, of course we are. The Orgone Accumulator.
The Orgone Accumulator, which we all actually know of because Kate Bush sang Cloudbusting about Reich and his wild ideas. So Reich invented this device, which is like basically a phone box. Remember phone boxes? And you climb inside it. And he believed it charged you up with a kind of life energy and that healed you. This is where Reich and I part ways, because I do not think that getting into a kind of phone box is going to save any of us. But I think it's really interesting that Reich had this invention that's a sort of almost like a prison cell. And what happens to him is imprisonment. And that is an end that is not just something that happens to Reich. It happens to so many people involved in freedom movements. So he sort of led me to consider ideas about imprisonment and incarceration, which remain immensely live in our own century.
Yeah, and you certainly, that's kind of what we come to that section a little bit later into the book. But if I can bring you right back, because to get a sense of where you started to look at things and possibly to look at the things with the particular angle you do look at things, you grew up in Thatcher's Britain and you were the child of a gay relationship, lesbian mother. Now, that can't have been it must have been challenging in its own way. Did your interest in the body, does it go right back that far? Were you already kind of formulating ideas around the body and how we're judged in terms of body in that way?
I was a very precocious child. I wouldn't say at seven, but no, I think it really is very formative to know that you are from a family, from a sort of loving relationship that nonetheless is regarded as undesirable by the state. And this is the era of Section 28, the law that really criminalized gay families. That's a foundational experience. And then I think to go on gay rights marches, which I went to my first one at 11 at the height of the AIDS crisis. So to suddenly feel, okay, this identity that individually can feel shameful and dangerous, when we are together, it's suddenly an opportunity for solidarity and power. So those experiences, which I had very young and are available to anyone, I think they really, really stayed with me. They gave me the sense that there is a lot going on with our human bodies that aren't talked about.
In as we move into the book, you've mentioned some of the names already that you talk about, and Susan Sontag being, I think, possibly the first major one that you get into after you've introduced us to Reich and his orgone accumulator and the things he likes to get up to in the orgone accumulator, which I will come back to. Now, illness is a big part of the Susan Sontag story. Was it illness? I think you contend that it actually was illness that woke her up to her body in many ways.
Sontag is so interesting because she's somebody who really denied the experience of her body. She didn't wash, she wouldn't sleep, she barely ate, she smoked cigarettes all the time and took amphetamines to sort of deny the existence of her body. And then she gets cancer, and cancer really is the experience that makes her realize that she is a person in a body. She isn't just this sort of mind floating in a Petri dish, as she might have wished. She's also an embodied presence. And it makes her think about all kinds of things, about power, about society, about money, all of those questions that illness throws up, and especially about her own emotional background, about her family, because those kind of questions are called up on us when we experience sickness, and especially serious illness.
Did she think she could cheat death? Was this part of what was going on? She thought that she somehow had a body that could go on forever. Now, obviously, she was an intelligent woman. She knew she couldn't cheat death. But do you think there was something like that going on inside her body?
She says it over and over again. I mean, she really has this fantasy that perhaps she might be the one who doesn't have to die. It's in her diary. She says it to her son at some point. Well, maybe we won't have to die. Mm. And I think that was very strong for her. I think she believed that she was a mind so intensely that the idea that she could die, that she could have a fallible body, was very foreign to her.
You also mentioned that many of the people that you talk about in the book are problematic in their own ways. Andrea Dworkin was another one that you mentioned. Give us a little bit of her background and what makes her so problematic.
I encountered Dworkin in the 1990s, as many people did, and this was the era where second wave feminism was being torn apart by the porn wars. The question of, is pornography a good thing? Is it liberating for women, or is it incredibly oppressive? Dworkin believed the latter. She thought it was oppressive. So I felt that she wasn't a character I was particularly interested in. And then recently, in the last few years, her work has been republished, and I came to read it, and I was astounded by the power of her voice, the sort of things she was saying, how relevant her writing about rape and sexual violence felt. And then also her own story, which I didn't know, which that she was in a very violent marriage when she was a young woman. She escaped from her husband. And she began writing out of that position, this desire to testify to the reality of violence. And I think, you know, I'm very sad that this is true, but that remains as relevant as it did in the 1970s. So her voice feels bitingly important right now.
Yeah, and violence is a very important theme within the book as well. The intersection of violence and sex, and more importantly, sex and power. That really, sex and power is at the heart of many of the arguments you're making here.
I think so, yeah. I think that they remain absolutely crucial, and they're crucial to Reich. This is one of the things that he was talking about.
Because this is the thing about Reich, you know, that you do manage. It's not that, you have to be really clear, you're not rehabilitating him, but you're saying, don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. You know, don't go bang an orgone accumulator. Kurt Cobain gave it a go, I think, at a party, didn't he?
Didn't help him, did it?
No, it didn't work for Kurt. But that we do have to look at everybody. We have to keep our minds open all the time.
I think so. And I think the thing with Reich is, you know, he was a sexual liberationist, and he had the misfortune really to be taken up after his death by some pretty dodgy men. Norman Mailer becomes his great champion. So brilliant. You've got this sort of misogynist championing you. And that means that Reich is remembered in the culture as the orgasm guy, somebody who's just saying orgasms will make you free. Well, no.
Oh, no, you're back. You're back there, Olivia, are you? Are you back?
I'm back.
Something happened there. You disappeared briefly. And just when you were talking about the interesting part of Wilhelm Reich and the orgasm and I suppose sexual energy is what he was talking about. Sexual energy as a great healer, is that putting it correctly?
I think this is what gets said about Reich a lot, and I don't really agree with this. I don't think he's just about sexual energy and orgasms. I think the thing about Reich is that he comes from a violent marriage. His parents his father brutalized his mother because she had an affair and she ended up killing herself. And I think really Reich's entire vision comes back to that experience. That what he's saying is he wants women to be able to have sexual lives without the fear of violence or violent death. And that is revolutionary. It remains revolutionary almost 100 years after he began to say it. And this is why the feminists loved Reich. His vision is absolutely a vision of an end to patriarchy.
You mentioned that Reich himself ended up in prison towards the end of his life, and this allows you, or it brings the argument into the area of prison and what prison is all about. You're speaking about Malcolm X, for whom, in his own words, not to simplify things, prison, he kind of says, wasn't the worst thing that could happen to him. It kind of saved him in some ways.
Malcolm X was in a very specific kind of prison, the like of which isn't really found these days. He was in a sort of reform prison which had an astonishing library. And Malcolm X didn't find the experience of being in prison liberating. He found the experience of living in a library liberating. Yeah. So this is the moment when he realized everything that had happened to him in his childhood, the lynching of his father, the separation from his mother, the extraordinary racism that he'd experienced wasn't a coincidence. It wasn't an individual story. It was a social structure that permeated everything. And when he realized that, he awakened as an activist. He awakened as a revolutionary. So it's not so much prison as books that liberated Malcolm X.
Yeah, he happened to be in prison when he was introduced to the library. I suppose that's a very different thing than
Absolutely.
prison
yeah.
changing his life. I suppose the other aspect of all of this is, you know, if we talk about the body and we think of where we are at the moment, we think of COVID. You were writing this just as the pandemic was beginning to take hold and all of the lockdowns, et cetera, were beginning to take place. How do you think that the COVID story fits into the argument, if you were adding an addendum to it this evening? Where would it fit into the everybody argument?
I think COVID has shown us a kind of bodily precariousness that lots of people have been sheltered from, and now they see it in a way that people who are more at risk understand that as their daily reality. And I think the other thing about the experience of all of these successive lockdowns is it's made us all realize how much we long for bodily life. We don't want to live on the internet. We don't want to have digital conversations with our friends. We want to be together. We want to see performances. We want to dance. We want to be in rooms with other people and to see what unexpected things happen when people's bodies are together.
And I wait for the time and look forward to the time, Olivia Lang, when our bodies can be opposite each other in the studio rather than down the line with something happening. It's been really interesting to speak with you this evening, and thank you, for a really thought-provoking set of arguments in the book Everybody, or Everybody, whichever way you want me to say it. Olivia Lang and Everybody, A Book About Freedom, is published by Picador. Over the course of this week, we have brought you poems from three of the four finalists in the 2021 Moth Poetry Prize. The prize was originally set up 10 years ago, 2011, to help boost the careers of poets from around the world who submit previously unpublished works to the Moth magazine. Tonight, we're delighted to bring you the winning poem, chosen from 4,000 entries and judged in the blind by this year's judge, the current chair of creative writing at the Seamus Heaney Centre, Nick Laird. So the winning poem, based in Utah, American poet Michael Lavers submitted a poem called Chaos Soliloquy, described by Judge Nick Laird as both a rant and a pain to disorder. Congratulations to Michael Lavers, and we bring you now his winning entry, Chaos Soliloquy.
Not what they think I am, these creatures on the bus. Not just the shoeless man slumped in the back or tense under the overpass on Seaview Road. A mere gazillionth of the whole of me. Bolus of ocelots and astral gases and bent light. This woman in the mauve dress doesn't know I haunt the organ score she holds as freely as I fill her grandson's headphones. Noise like Visigoths ransacking Rome. That man in coat and tie? I am that coat and tie, and I'm what spiked his email with a typo that had students rummaging for clues about the whiteness of the whale in chapter 4 instead of 42. I led him to his wife and her into her migraine's third straight week. Those sirens, rubble, traffic, shattered glass, me, 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 me. But then there's broom me, stretcher me, bright, floppy body me, being revived. Just look around. All this was sea once, then a mountain. Now there's jamba juices everywhere, and far past them something called Mexico. You're welcome. Still, the organist would banish me, and hopes her grandson will exchange the clamor of smashed temples for the hum of Luther's harmonies. But why? I midwife all she loves. I am the dissonance that makes the mighty fortress of her song so sweet, a bulwark from my barbarous and silent shadows, endless cold, thick mist. Nor will the teacher ever feel the sunlight like his wife will when the migraine lifts, not as a curse, but as a cure, a consolation lavish and complete. Isn't it great? Me cells quadrupling, me sculptor of luminous noise, me hullabaloo. I wander lonely as a universe. I'm everything, all matter and all time, all lesser scrapes and major spills, rumor and fact, structure and strife, the smallest tributaries and their sum, the sea. I'm all the joyous weeping of the world, and from my everything some sudden spark might come, some unplanned sense, some happy turn. Woman holding a balance by Vermeer. Snow falling on moving water. Rorgar, Hrothgar, and Holga the Good. Today the teacher woke to find his dead lawn purpled with the petals of his neighbor's trees. Kudos to me. Could be that chapter 4, with Ishmael and Queequeg snuggled up, the leg of one flopped tenderly over the other in the cold New Bedford dawn, contains the true key to the whale's hue. Maybe his students, sacks of mostly water still might become what he has always wanted them to be. Little grenades of joy books are the fuses to, swooning and dazed, finding texts everywhere. The most inspired readers in the world.
There you go. And that is the winner of the 2021 Moth Poetry Prize, Michael Lavers, and his poem, Chaos Soliloquy. Damien Otuma has been in touch. Any chance that we could play Orgone Accumulator by Hawkwind, inspired by William Reich? Classic track. Thanks a million. Love the show. Well, there you go. That's certainly a song that we'll have to pass on to Olivia Lang. She already knows about the Kate Bush one. That is our lot for this Thursday evening here on Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched the programme this evening. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan. Oh, by the way, let me tell you about our albums tomorrow night. Quite excited about the Marianne Faithfull bringing her interpretations to the Romantic Era Poetry with music by composer Warren Alice. We'll also have the latest from Adrian Crowley and Teenage Fan Club. And we're looking at season 2 of This Time with Alan Partridge, which starts tomorrow night on the BBC. We'll be talking about it before you can watch it on the